It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's a look at why junk food and fast food are pure Americana. Our guest is American food historian Andrew Smith. Now, the way he tells it, between the Erie Canal and Ben Franklin, our destiny had nowhere else to go. His book is The Encyclopedia of Junk Food and Fast Food. Food & Wine's Ray Isle tells us what to look for to find that good $10 bottle of wine. Then it's a man after my own heart, the botany professor whose vegetable garden is weeds. And he has 1,000 recipes for dandelions. I'm challenged once again in our refrigerator game, Stump the Cook. The bacchanal is presided over by our celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. Been up in Vermont recently because it's so close to you.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, you used to laugh at us because, you know, every other thing we would talk to you about on the radio was in Vermont.
Yeah.
And we didn't go to Vermont for a while. Well, we went back.
Darn you, and
it was worth it. You know what fans of good breakfast places we are? We found a place called Up for Breakfast in the beautiful town of Manchester, Vermont. And we found a dish that just knocked our socks off. It's wild turkey hash.
Wild turkey hash?
Yes, ma'am.
But wait a minute. It's called wild turkey hash not because it is made from wild turkeys, but because it is wildly assembled. Okay. It's a kind of tour de force. I mean, it's got big shreds of moist roasted turkey with peppers, onions, potatoes, and pine nuts, all griddle cooked until it's really crusty brown. It's topped with poached eggs and a film of fine hollandaise sauce. I mean, it's really a great breakfast.
I thought maybe the wild turkey might have had something to do with something that comes in a bottle.
Well, that would be fine, too.
They do have fine mimosas at this place, but I did not see them offer wild turkey, no.
You know, it's a funny place because if we're saying, you know, wild turkey hash and they have this, you know, incredible chicken duck cilantro sausage. It sounds very yuppie and kind of upscale. But in fact, it is a very, very humble little place.
And it really is. I mean, the name of the place, Up for Breakfast, I mean, means two things. It means you're up for breakfast, but also it means you go upstairs for breakfast because it's located up a very precarious staircase on the second floor of a building. So you've got to walk up one flight of stairs to get there.
It also won my award. I mean, you probably didn't know that I had this award. Nobody did. Of having the pancakes with the most blueberries in them that I have ever seen in my life. Normally, I just get plain old buttermilk pancakes, but because we were in New England, I got pancakes with wild Maine blueberries in them. And I think these were like three-quarter berries
and a quarter batter.
Yes.
I see Jane doing a count. One, two, three. Pulling the pancake apart.
I have my little abacus next to me.
But amazingly, they stay together as pancakes. I mean, that's the miracle thing about these. As much blueberries as there are, they don't fall apart. And, you know, you put some good maple syrup on top of that. Mm. That is quite good.
Do they do other stuff, too? I mean, they've got the pancakes and they've got the wild turkey hash. Other stuff.
Well, how about slabs of sourdough bread that are made into French toast? I mean, that attain the consistency of custard almost.
Yeah, the French toast there is made using big slabs of spicy bread. It's kind of like a cinnamon bread.
Mm-hmm.
And as Michael said earlier, you know, when you're in Vermont, you don't have the, you know, repulsiveness of getting that jar of supermarket, quote, maple syrup put in front of you that has never seen a maple tree or a bucket. I mean, they could serve you napkins, and if you put this wonderful maple syrup on it, it would be fine. They also sell maple syrup from their local farms.
And also, I should say, one other thing they make there that is a real New England thing is excellent, excellent muffins, blueberry muffins, corn muffins. Oh. You can have them either fresh out of the pan, I mean, still hot from the oven, or what they will do, and this is kind of for the sybarite among us, they will slice them in half, butter them, and then grill them. So you get that real crusty inside part as well.
What else is in Manchester?
Shopping.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Well, it's a just a beautiful, beautiful, pristine New England town, you know, the white steeple churches. Mm. But I do have to say that they do have some of the great outlet stores of all time. And so, you know, after you tank up, you know, for breakfast, you can burn off all your calories at the Ralph Lauren outlet.
And while Jane is shopping for things, I'm going to Mrs. Murphy's Donuts, which is just up the street from Up for Breakfast, where they make donuts every morning. That's like the local hangout. People come in and their donuts are on the counter before they even sit down because everybody knows what they want.
I think also in Manchester, Orvis,
the outfitters, right?
Yeah. Thank you. Has a falconry school.
Yes, it's out of there.
Where they teach you how to hunt with falcons.
And always a useful skill.
Well, the falcons come back with wild turkey hash.
A whole plate of it.
Or the falcons hang out at Mrs. Murphy's Donuts with Michael.
I love Michael having dessert after his breakfast. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, right now, little spring potatoes are in the market, and the lamb is absolutely prime. I have to tell you, a lot of lamb dishes have passed between these lips, but there's one that stands out, and it's so simple that you think it wouldn't work. You layer chunks of lamb and slices of potato in a casserole, you pour in a little water, and you bake it. I mean, you season the lamb, but you don't have any browning or fiddling around with a lot of ingredients. The lamb turns tender, and the potatoes pick up all of the good flavors, and they get this almost fudgy consistency. The dish is called Ninth Night Lamb, and you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, be sure to register for Weeknight Kitchen. It's our e-newsletter devoted to simplifying your culinary life midweek. Now, every week we send you a weeknight supper recipe and shopping and technique tips. And you will also find free podcasts of our show. I mean, you can take us anywhere. A rather frightening thought. Anyway, check it all out. splendidtable.org. In the best of all possible worlds, picking up a fine little $50 Cabernet to go with tonight's steak on the grill would be no problem. But in our real world, what you're probably looking for on the way home from work is a great little $10 bottle. Those $10 bottles do exist. The question is, how do you tell if they're drinkable? Well, Ray Isle ponders these things. He's senior wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Ray, welcome.
That's great to be here, Lynn. Thanks.
Ray, when you talk about wines that are $10, are there certain simple things that we could know that would help us know where to find the bargain in wines?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of like key rules, or maybe not rules, but suggestions.
Uh-huh.
One of them is, and it's a basic thing with wine, if you have a very specific regional description, if it says, you know, Napa Valley or Russian River Valley, that's going to be more expensive than a wine that comes with just a broad California appellation. Just by looking at that on the shelf, you'll know that you're looking at a wine that's sourced from a wide region as opposed to from a specific region.
Right.
A little more affordable. Second nice little trick is white wines that don't spend time in oak tend to be less expensive than white wines that do. And it's very simply because oak barrels, you know, especially French oak barrels, cost you $600 a pop. So
how do you, tell, though? How do you know that?
Well, the best way is just kind of keep in mind some of the grapes that are typically not put in oak. For instance, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, Chenin Blanc would be another one.
Okay.
And Pinot Grigio, case in point. And those, you know, if you keep those four in mind, for instance, you'll typically be finding grapes that are not oaked. And Chardonnay is the classic one that is oaked, and you know you're paying for those barrels when you buy that wine. Search out unfamiliar grapes rather than Chardonnay. Try Torrontés from Argentina, for instance. That's in the column in February in our magazine. We recommended a Santa Isabel Torrontés, 2006 Santa Isabel Torrontés, and this is a lovely grape. It's light, it's delicate, it's a little peach flavor, somewhere a little of the tartness of Sauvignon Blanc and the softness of Pinot Grigio. It's Argentina's main white grape, but who knows it?
You know. So the lesser-known grape. If you've never heard of it, this may be a good thing to try. Is that essentially the way to go?
It's essentially supply and demand. There's a lot of demand for Chardonnay. It's the biggest-selling grape in the U.S. Torrontés, people really want to sell it, but nobody knows what it is, so the prices are good.
And you're saying it comes from Argentina.
It comes from Argentina.
Where maybe labor costs are lower, too?
And that's another key consideration, look to the regions, South America, for instance, where labor costs are just radically lower than Napa Valley. Also because when you're looking at a prestige region like Napa Valley, you're paying an extra $10 to have Napa Valley on the label. It's like buying Prada as opposed to JCPenney's.
So we've got the Torrontés. Can you name some other names, some things to look for?
A couple others that were, I think, terrific, for $10 and under. 2004 Veramonte Merlot. This is a Chilean wine, Merlot Reserva, actually. $10. Mm-hmm. This is from a family, the Junius family, who've been making wine in Chile for a long time. But they also make a very, very high-end California wine called Quintessa, which is a fabulous Cabernet for $100.
Yeah.
And, you often think of Chilean Cabernets. You think of Chilean Sauvignon Blanc. This is a Merlot. Merlot's gotten beaten up a little bit in the past few years.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of considered the wine of mediocrity, right?
It is, and it kind of deserved that rap because there was a lot of bad Merlot out there for a long time. This is exactly what Merlot ought to be. It's juicy, the flavors are intense, it's plummy, but it's not sort of sweet and goopy and totally characterless. And, for $10, it's unbeatable. Another one, Australia is still producing fabulous bargains, especially if you look for some of the quirkier producers. There's a wine I like a lot called the Stump Jump by Darenberg.
Stump Jump?
The Stump Jump. Chester Osborne, who's the winemaker and owner at Darenberg, is the one who started coming up with these crazy names for Australian wines. I think he was the first guy to do it. So he's got wines called the Money Spider and the Galvo Garage and the Dead Arm. I don't know what's going on with that. But the Stump Jump is it's classic Grenache Shiraz Mourvèdre blend, Australian, big, juicy, intense, dark,
red.
Black red.
Right.
Perfect grilling wine, perfect barbecue wine. And, again, $10. It's a unbeatable juice.
Hey, drink cheap. I love it. Hey,
right.
Ray, thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Lynn. It's great being here.
Ray Isle is senior wine editor for Food & Wine magazine. The article Best Wines $10 and Under appeared in the February 2007 issue of Food & Wine. Now, you can find Ray's wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, fast food, junk food, and how Ben Franklin made us do it. And stop tramping over your dinner, foraging for supper. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at supertarget.com. Well, you see pop culture books on junk food and fast food all the time, but rarely is there a scholarly look at these two with the kind of detail that shows how they could play in American life. Well, American food historian Andrew Smith took on the task. He's author of Encyclopedia of Junk Food and Fast Food. And Andy, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be here, Lynn.
Very direct title, sir, I have to say.
Well, I thought it explained what I was writing about very well.
But where did you set the parameters on this?
Yeah, that was a problem because there are lots of junk foods and lots of fast foods too. So I focus solely on commercial foods, beginning with Cracker Jack in 1896, and fast food really beginning with White Castle. Obviously, both of those are parts of earlier trends in America, and I tried to put them into historical context.
Is this kind of a case where this kind of food is ours, all ours? I mean, is this really an American phenomenon?
Certainly fast food and junk food originated, at least commercial foods originated in the United States. It was Ben Franklin who made the statement that time is money and time matters a lot. So Americans simply concluded that the faster that they ate, the much more money they could make doing other things. So Americans have consistently made that decision for over 200 years.
You said to me at one time that people coming to this country to visit from other countries documented that Americans were shoveling down a meal in 4 minutes or something on that order.
Yeah, there are a lot of descriptions of Europeans who came into the what's today the United States in the 18th century and the 19th century, and their absolute shock with the speed with which Americans ate. And in boarding houses where those descriptions were particularly appalling. You had descriptions of the dining room being opened at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and at 4:04, the food was gone. People were getting up and leaving.
Well, you've got so many tidbits in the book I really want to talk about. Now, for instance, you've got a chronology of fast food and junk food. Could you talk about what happened in 1825?
The Erie Canal was completed in 1825, and it really changed American food habits. Prior to that time, most Americans ate food that they either grew in their farm or alternately they bought it locally. And the Erie Canal made it possible for farmers to grow wheat particularly and other products hundreds of miles away from where it was consumed. And that's the beginning step of where Americans have been separated from the food that they grew by hundreds and now thousands of miles.
Let's talk about a real industrial food, a real snack food, Twinkies. Where did they begin?
Twinkies are wonderful. They're started with a company that has home base in St. Louis, but actually the person who discovered Twinkies happened to be a baker in Chicago. And what their problem was is they made shortcake. And shortcake was really only good during the summer when you had strawberries around. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do with the manufacturing operation during the winter? So they tried to get a product that they could create that would be consumed over the year. And then one of the bakers ended up with what we think of as a Twinkie today. And initially it had a banana filling. And it became very quickly one of America's most popular baked goods. During World War II, bananas were not accessible, and so they shifted it to the white cream that's in there today. It has been America's number one bakery snack food for almost 50 years.
Wow. Okay, let's talk salty stuff now. What do you see as a real iconic food, something that has a great story to tell about us?
Oh, I think almost all the snack foods have great stories to tell about them. One of them, of course, I love is Fritos. And Fritos has its origin in an out-of-work Depression-era salesman. And he happened to be in San Antonio, and he happened to get a tortilla that had been cut up into small strips and had been salted. And he said, "This is really great. I can sell this." So he started bagging it in his house. It became popular in San Antonio. So he constructed a manufacturing operation. It sold in the Southwest. Then he met up with Herman Lay. And Herman Lay said, "Well, listen, I can distribute this nationally," which in fact they did. And it became one of America's most important corporations. By when Elmer Doolin died in 1959, the company itself merged with Herman Lay and became Frito-Lay, which was then purchased and acquired by PepsiCo and is now the largest snack food company in the world.
Cheetos. Now, how did they come about?
Oh, I love Cheetos.
I love Cheetos, too.
Well, you may not eat them if you know the truth. It starts off in an animal feed operation in the 1930s.
You're kidding.
A man by the name of Edward Wilson figured out that it was possible to extrude grain, warm grain, and put it into a very cold environment, and it would puff up. And so the first product happened to be corn kernels, of which he produced and were later became very popular in the 1950s. The Frito-Lay company took a look at this and said, "Wow, this is pretty good stuff." And in the late 1940s, they began experimenting and invented Cheetos in 1948. Likewise, with their work with Herman Lay, they became national in scope, and they have become one of America's most popular extruded snacks.
I'm having a picture here of Herman Lay looking over the fence at pigs eating the corn puffs and saying, "Boy, you know what? We could do something with that."
I can just see this.
Pigs and humans are both omnivores. We eat the same food, so that's not at all a surprise if, in fact, it did happen.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
American food historian Andrew Smith is author of Encyclopedia of Junk Food and Fast Food, and he's editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. "99.9% of life is perception, as in the old glasses half full business. One man's yuck is another man's feast, and what a gardener calls a weed, a botanist might see another way. Or in other words, do not touch that dandelion until you hear this from Julie Grant."
Hello?
Hi there, kiddo.
Peter Gale moves me quickly from the front door, through the house, and out the back door to show off the garden in his small fenced-in backyard in a Cleveland suburb. It doesn't seem like much to look at. Spring weeds are poking out of the cracks of the sandstone patio.
This is my vegetable garden. You're standing in my vegetable garden. See my dandelions? Dandelion in crack there. Gill over the ground.
Gill over the ground. It's usually just called ground ivy. Gale didn't plant it. It just grows all over. You can see its pinkish, heart-shaped leaves in the woods and along roadsides. If you feel the stem, it's square. Gale smooshes a leaf between his fingers.
Now, is this a mint?
Yeah, that's a mint. And you can smell, sort of smell the mint. It's an earthy smell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that is ground ivy, gill over the ground, and that is growing all through in here.
And you'll eat that mint?
I'll make tea out of that mint. It's very rich in vitamin C, and it's a good tea for leaching toxic metals out of your system from the wintertime.
Sounds pretty serious, leaching out toxic metals. But Gale's true weed love is the bane of many a well-manicured green lawn, the dandelion. Turns out it's one of the most nutritious plants out there, rich in lecithin, vitamin A, calcium, and potassium. Gale says people from cultures the world over know this, except for Americans.
They were brought over initially by the English on ships. They were brought over by the Italians. They were brought over by the Lebanese. They were brought over by the Greeks. They were brought over by the Spanish. They were brought over by the Polish, by the Croatians, by every single group that ever came to these shores brought dandelions with them. If they didn't bring them initially, they sent home for them.
Gale has collected about 1,000 dandelion recipes from more than 60 countries, from dandy burgers that are made from the flowers to a rich-flavored drink made from the roots. If you catch the leaves early in the spring, they're a nice addition to salads. Later in the season, they can taste bitter and might need to be cooked with a little sweetener to mellow out the taste. Gale learned to eat dandelions and other so-called weeds when he was a boy. His father died, and the family didn't have much money.
My mother had no experience, and so a friend told her we could live off lamb's quarters, which is a wild spinach. And so every day my brother and I would go out into the backyard. We would gather the young tops of lamb's quarters, bring them in, and she would make the most wonderful spinach dishes out of them we ever had.
Now in his 60s, Gale has spent his career as a botany professor. He's got plenty of money, but he still loves lamb's quarters and the rest of those backyard snacks. He says these plants are outside nearly every back door, but homeowners spend money on herbicides to kill them, then buy the same greens in gourmet food stores and fancy restaurants because they don't know that what they're calling weeds are actually healthy and delicious.
Their grandparents knew them. But as the years went by and they became more urban, they came into these suburbs where people wanted clean lawns and all. Nobody ever taught them these plants. I mean, their grandparents tried, grandmother tried. They said, "Oh, Grandma, we don't need that. We have money now. That was what we ate when we were poor. Now we can go to the store and buy stuff." And so they never taught their kids. Now we're three generations down and nobody knows anything. You know, they can walk out the door, they can walk right over dinner, a much more nutritious dinner than they can buy at the grocery store.
But Gale is on a mission to change that. He tours the country teaching people from Boy Scouts to cooking clubs about the wild edibles growing all over their own neighborhoods. He believes people should know how to feed themselves close to home.
Julie Grant is a reporter for Turnip Radio in Kent, Ohio. Botany professor Peter Gale did share one of his 1,000 dandelion recipes. It proves those dandelion flowers are to be treasured, not trashed. Now, you can find dandelion flower cookies on the website, splendidtable.org. It's a great project for the kids over the weekend. Oh, and while you're there, get to the front of the line to sign up for our upcoming brand new seasonal newsletter, The Griller's Chronicle. Now, it's going to run from June to September. Every week, you'll get a new grill recipe, along with our usual gems of piercing wisdom. But best of all, it's free. So sign up for Griller's Chronicle at splendidtable.org. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with 5 things that are in their refrigerator, nothing with green fuzz on it or anything shriveled, and I have to come up with a dish with those 5 ingredients that the caller would really eat. Now, the other judge is our noble stump master, Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Christopher, welcome.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. I love judging you.
I know.
What's
you
more
do.
Fun? It's a... Unfortunately, no money changes hands.
Okay, so shall we find out who's calling?
Yeah, we have Marcus on the line today. Marcus, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Great, and do you have 5 ingredients?
I do indeed.
And what would they be?
I have pheasant.
Pheasant?
I have goose liver.
Holy cow, excuse me.
I have some dandelion greens, some wild leeks that I have out in the woods, and some... spice bush. It's also called Indian pepper, but it's a wild herb that grows out here.
Do you go out and forage? Obviously you do.
Yes.
Okay, now tell me this. Is the pheasant cooked or uncooked?
It's not cooked.
Okay. And did you hunt the pheasant?
Yes.
Oh, great. All right. Okay, so we got pheasant, goose liver, just that little moment where you had a little foie gras hanging around, right? Dandelion greens, wild leeks, and Indian pepper, which I'm gathering is a little spicy and it's a wild berry or herb.
Right.
Okay. Now, I get for free water, salt, pepper, and some kind of fat. But you have to have it really in your cupboard, okay? And then 3 things. 3 things, but you have to really have them in the house. So I think what I'd like is some kind of fat. I mean, do you have
butter.
Goose fat? You have butter?
I have butter, and I also have goose grease because it was a big goose.
Oh, boy. Let's do the goose fat. All right. The other thing is I'm going to need shallots or garlic or onion.
Well, will the wild leeks do?
The wild leeks will do, but I need something a little sweet with that, too. So how about some onion?
Okay.
All right. So we have onion, and the fat is free. The other thing, and we've got dandelion greens. How about a bit of sherry or balsamic vinegar?
Well,
he's going to ask whether you want a 5 years age or 30 years.
Yeah, I have sherry. I have balsamic vinegar. I also have an onion cooking wine.
All right. You know what? Let's do this. Let's do the sherry vinegar. Everybody does balsamic.
Okay.
That's much too easy. So I've got onion, I've got sherry vinegar, and I need one more thing. And I'm thinking with the dandelion greens.
Didn't you already get goose fat, onions, and sherry vinegar?
Well, remember, the goose fat's the free fat.
The goose fat is the free fat,
and I get water. Ah, do you have any broth in the house? You know, like chicken broth.
Yeah,
it could even be in a can. We're not proud.
Yeah, I do. It's goose broth, but yeah.
I have to say, everything
but the honk.
Well, where's Jacques Pepin when you need him?
Exactly.
This is perfect
exactly.
for him.
All right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take the pheasant, and we're going to essentially divide it up. And what we're going to do is, because I have found that pheasant's legs taste like they're rubber bands, taste like the bird was running, you know, the 4-minute mile, whereas the breast can be really tender. So you're going to cut off the legs and thighs and put those on the side, and you're going to take the breast and you're going to cut that. You could leave it on the bone if you want. If you want to be really classy, you could trim it off the bone. And what you're going to do is take the pheasant legs, and you're going to brown them in a little bit of goose fat, and you're going to do a real, like, medium heat, slow brown on that, adding the leek and adding the onion and the Indian pepper and a bit of salt, all right? And once they get really nicely browned, you're going to pour in about a half a cup of that sherry vinegar and a little bit of the broth, maybe a half a cup of the broth. And you're going to cover that with, and you're going to let it cook an hour and a half until they're really tender and they're almost, you know, the meat is just on the border.
This sounds so good. It sounds like sex.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a braised legs of the animal.
I can see it. You're getting hungry.
Yeah, well, it's going to be utterly delicious. So now, once that's done, once the meat is tender, you're going to lift that out. You're going to keep it warm. You're going to boil down those pan juices until they're almost syrupy. And you're going to take those and put that sort of like in a cup. You know, just set that aside. Now what you're going to do is wipe out the pan, put in a teeny bit more of the goose fat, and you're going to quickly sear the breasts, and especially if you've taken them off the bone, this is going to take 3 minutes, a minute on each side to sear it. Lower the heat, cook it another 2 to 3 minutes. You want them blushed pink all the way through. Salt and pepper, okay, on this. A bit more of the Indian pepper and a little bit more of very thin sliced wild
leek. Did you say blushed?
Blushed
you're getting,
pink.
Yeah, the Thomas Hardy of the kitchen.
You've got it.
You're a poet. Yeah.
Yes, right. Yes, blushed pink. I don't know how poetic that is, but that's what a pheasant breast should be. Right. Blushed pink. Keep that warm. Into that same pan, you're going to put the trimmed dandelion greens. You'll have cut them into thin ribbons. And you're going to give that a very fast sauté until they wilt. Add a little broth. Cook that down until they're tender. Salt, pepper, no Indian pepper, just salt and pepper. Okay? Set that on a serving platter. Put the still warm legs and thighs arranged on the ends of that platter, still on the bed of the greens. All right. Then you take the cooked breast, you thinly slice that, you lay that over the greens in the center of the platter, and now you're going to slice up the goose liver into half-inch thick pieces, do a really fast sear in that pan.
Okay.
All right. You're going to throw all those lovely pan juices you boiled down back into the pan to heat it up. And you're going to pour that over the whole thing. And you have got essentially braised dandelion greens with pheasant two ways and one of the best pieces of the goose that you could possibly have.
So, Marcus, thank you for throwing a slow fastball right over the middle of the plate. I mean, this was... Actually, this is the splendid French table we're
that
here.
That is wonderful. Yeah.
But, I mean, really, would you try it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it sounds involved, but you know what it is. It's the steps.
No doubt. That sounds great.
Hey, Marcus, thank you for playing Stump the Cook.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Christopher, thank you so much, sir, for being a wonderful stump master.
I just wanted to eat it. That was an A. That was a winner.
I can't believe I actually got you. Our guest celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cooks Illustrated and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me in Stump the Cook, give us a call, 800-537-5252. One of our secretive producers may call you to be on the air. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what's a name for dandelion in French? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we'll be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is a name for dandelion in French? Now, remember what botanist Peter Gale said about how dandelions and other weeds are good for us. Well, a word in French for dandelion is pissenlit, which translates as wet the bed. Talk about cleansing. Pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get going. We have got Sean on the line from Cross Plains, Tennessee. Hey, Sean, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. Well, it's the the time of year for planting stuff.
Yes, it is, at last.
At last. And I love to cook with fresh herbs. But I'd really like to expand my herb garden a little bit more from what I've got right now, and I haven't got a clue what to plant.
Well, what have you got already?
Well, currently I've got rosemary and oregano. They're established perennials that come back every year. They're wonderful.
Right.
I've got some cilantro out there that reseeds itself, mm-hmm. and I plant basil every year and dry some tomatoes. I've tried garlic and I've tried ginger, and they don't grow here real well.
They don't do really well in Tennessee. Well, first of all, just off the top of my head, you know, you realize you're talking to the basil obsessed woman of the upper Midwest, at least. There are more kinds of basil out there right now than you can possibly count. And, you know, let's back up. I just realized something. Let's start this in the kitchen. Do you like to cook Asian food?
Yes.
Okay. Thai basil. Also sometimes known as holy basil. It's really interesting because it has a slight anise quality, but yet it doesn't taste like anise. It is very almost fruity tasting. That would be a great thing to try. And you know, there's a little basil. It looks like a teeny little bush with tiny leaves. It's called spicy globe basil. And when I was in Sicily, people were making a pesto with that, with crushed almonds and garlic and cheese, and then a ton of that, those little leaves, and it's really fabulous. I mean, there's chocolate basil, and there's mint basil, and there's, you know, lemon basil. I mean, you could go on forever there.
Right. I'm a little limited as to what varieties I can get locally, although I can get seed catalogs.
Yeah, you can. And, you know, there's a lot of, there's Cook's Garden, and there's Shepherd's, and, you know, there's a lot of good seed people out there that could help you out with that. And also, because basil really grows fairly quickly, you could stagger planting, because you always want it to be, the best basil is just before it flowers. So you could stagger. I mean, if you do seeds now, you'll still have it coming up, you know, because you have a longer season.
Right. Yeah. Well, I get probably about 6 months of decent basil.
I don't want to hear about that. Oh, dear Sean. Okay. Enough crying. Thyme. Thyme is a perennial. It's hardy. A great place to plant thyme is along paths between flagstones, because as you brush it, you get this wonderful scent. And there's golden thyme, which is beautiful. There's a golden lemon thyme, which is just glorious. You can use it with anything, ham, lamb, vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it that's so great is that it comes back. I mean, it just keeps going.
Right.
You know, another herb that people just don't give enough credit to is lovage. And lovage grows like a weed. It has a leaf that resembles almost a chrysanthemum leaf. And it tastes like celery.
Huh.
So you can put it in chicken salads. You can put it in broths. Anywhere you want celery flavor.
I will have to look for some.
And it's great in salads. Just,
that's one of those plants that I read the name, I've heard it, I have never seen it.
Yeah, and it's kind of pretty, too. And I forgot to mention something. All of these herbs do flower, and those flowers are beautiful in salads, or just, you know, if you have a plate of roasted chicken that you've flavored with the herb, and you sprinkle the little tiny purple flowers over it as you bring it to the table, it's terribly shishi and hoo-ha, and, you know, people will be very impressed.
Good too.
And another thing, two things that are really kind of fun. One is called Egyptian onion. Now, this is really interesting because it propagates itself. It's long stalks that get a bulb at the end, a small bulb, a bulb about 2 inches or an inch and a half wide, maybe an inch and a half or 2 inches high. And that bulb will drop down and sends out tentacles and it replants itself. But you can eat that bulb and you can eat the entire stalk. It's tender and it has a delicate, lovely onion flavor. And it's called, I think it's called top onion or Egyptian onion, because the onion's at the top of the plant. And if you grow a fair amount of it, you know, part of it, let it recede, because it'll come back every year. And the other part, use it in places where you want a subtle onion flavor. And then garlic chives, because garlic chives, not only they're flat chives, they flat sort of sword-like leaf, but they are really delicious anywhere you want chive flavor and you want garlic flavor, but a little more delicate.
But what's great is they get the most beautiful flowers. They are white, and they are a cluster of star-shaped white flowers. Mm-hmm. So those are a few ideas for
those
you.
Those are wonderful ideas. Thank you so much. I'm going to rush out and start planting stuff immediately.
I'm picturing you're going to be digging in the dirt in 5 minutes. Hey, Sean, enjoy the garden.
I will. Thank
okay.
you.
Take
Happy
care.
Spring.
Hey, you too.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Oh, the thoughts, six-month growing season. Oh, the man can have an herb garden that dreams are made of. Oh, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Dana calling from Columbus. Hey, Dana, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, yeah, I have a question. I've been kind of exploring with cheeses.
Yeah?
And I'd heard about something I hadn't tried before called Manchego. It was actually mentioned in a song lyric by KMFDM, and I got a block of it. It's a hard cheese, but it's not, like, dry, like a really hard sharp cheddar.
Right, right. It's a great Spanish cheese, yes.
Yeah, and so far all I've been able to figure out to do with it is slice it thin and put it on buffalo burgers. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, first of all, just eating it straight. And one of the classic ways that it's eaten is with dried figs.
Ooh.
Believe it or not, you know, little chunks of it eaten with dried figs. And there's these great almonds that come out of Spain. They're sort of heart-shaped. And they're called Marcona, and they're salted. They are fabulous with the cheese. The other thing to think about doing with it is anything that's sort of like a sweet, spicy chutney, put the cheese on a cracker, piece of bread, put a teeny bit of that chutney on top of it, because Manchego has a nuttiness to it.
It does.
That can stand up to that. Another thing I like to do with it, even though it's not very traditional at all, is I'll dress pasta with it. I'll saute garlic and olive oil. I'll throw in maybe some chopped parsley, toss in cooked pasta, and then just shave a ton of Manchego over it.
I have to try it. It sounds good.
The other thing that's great is when we're talking about shaving the Manchego, over a green salad, big shavings of it. Use a vegetable peeler.
Okay.
Yeah, because that way you get the tart leaf, you get the vinegar and the oil, and then you get this creaminess. It's like a little sheet of silk that melts away in your mouth. Mm. And it's really great that way. It's one of the cheeses from Spain that has become extremely popular because it's friendly to so many things.
How well does it keep?
If you keep it tightly wrapped, I would say probably a month or more.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Enjoy it.
I shall. Thanks.
You take care. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Muffy calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Muffy, what do you want to talk about?
I am curious. I used to have something at my mother's about 20 years ago that I believe was called a mother. And it is, it was a very large jar with a lid on it.
Yeah.
And it was fruits that all, somehow as she added them, they brandied.
It was a case where you kept adding fruit and sugar and you kept adding fruit and sugar?
Yes, and none of us can remember how to start it or how to add or what we do.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that was popular for a period of time. It used to be called a Rumatoffen or Rumatoff also, if I recall. This would be the basic way you would do it, okay?
Okay.
You would never seal it. That would be the one thing, because you need air circulating.
Okay.
And I think the way you begin it is you do an equal amount of fruit and sugar.
Okay.
And the fruit can be almost any fruit. But it shouldn't have any bruising. You know, it should be in very good condition.
Okay.
And the idea that you would want is that you would want to take a large container with a wide mouth, because the air circulation is going to be important. And you would take one cup of sugar and one cup of fruit, put it in there, wait 4 or 5 days. Don't stir it initially. Maybe give it a stir, add another cup of fruit, another cup of sugar. The fruit should always be almost covered by the sugar. And what's going to happen is there's going to be a bit of fermentation that's going to start to occur.
Okay.
And every time you remove from it, always add whatever you've removed. So if, let's say you take a cup of this sugared, slightly woozy fruit out. You want to put a half a cup of sugar and a half a cup of fruit in.
Okay. Now, should it be fresh fruit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, although, you know, I think in the people used to actually use canned fruit, but I would say go for fresh fruit.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I, again, I, you know, the other thing is I would look this up online because this is a very dim memory on my part. And what I'm explaining to you, I think, would be perfectly safe.
Okay.
But you've got to, oh, this is one of the reasons you don't cover this. You want a lot of air circulating around it. Because
what do you put across the top, like a sieve or something? Or?
You could put some gauzy cloth across the top if you wanted. And also the other thing is, I think I would keep it away from light and I'd keep it away from a lot of heat.
Okay.
If you have that option.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it gets pretty hot in the summer, but, you know, if you can keep it in sort of the cool, dark place, it would be great.
Great.
Okay?
Thank you
very
much.
I think it's going to give you some real pleasure. You just need to wait a little bit.
Okay, terrific.
Okay.
Thank you.
You take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. I should add, by the way, that when you do an equal amount of fruit and sugar and you leave it sit overnight, open, don't cover it, what happens is the sugar permeates the fruit and it actually dries it in a strange way. In so many words, a lot of liquid is going to come out. And one of the tricks you can use for preserves is that if you're going to do peach preserves or that kind of thing, leave the sugar called for in the recipe with the fruit overnight. Drain off all the liquid that it produces the next day. Boil it down by half and then cook the fruit in it. You get an even more intense quality to the jam. So we know every star chef in the country now has digs in Las Vegas. We know Las Vegas is now family friendly. Well, how about female friendly? Molly Sullivan has co-authored Las Vegas Little Red Book, A Girl's Guide to the Perfect Vegas Getaway. Molly, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Pleasure to be here.
You know, I'm just thinking, in the 21st century, is this gender thing still going on? I mean, is it a case where men are treated differently in Las Vegas than a group of women would be?
Well, you know, I wouldn't go so far to saying that, but I will say that women can certainly have this city wrapped around their pinky. And certainly, you know, dining in Vegas is a form of entertainment unto itself and deserves the same amount of care you would lavish on choosing a hotel or show. And I think now in the 21st century, women understand that. And they're coming here for more than just gambling. You know, they're not letting their boyfriends or their husbands have all the fun. There's so much to do in this city, you know. And so that's exciting for me. I've lived here for 20-plus years, and I've really seen it evolve into, you know, the paradise that it is today for groups of women.
Now, this idea, though, of the very fancy restaurants where, where these very famous chefs are cooking, are there certain ones of these that are more friendly to a group of women than others?
Absolutely. First and foremost, if I can tell your audience one thing, is to book reservations when you book your hotel. And I think that people get here and they think that they can just, you know, tip away.
Yeah,
you know, we're
a
city built on customer service. And you can, but we all work very hard for our money. And I think, you know, if you just do a little planning ahead and, you know, those celebrity chefs like Wolfgang, he brought Spago in 92, and with that his signature designer pizzas with caviar and goat cheese and all that good lovely stuff. But since then, you know, a whole wave of celebrity dining has come. You know, and you can get your reservation at 7 p.m. All you need to do is book when you book your hotel room.
Yeah, so really book way ahead. But again, are there certain restaurants that you think for a group of women are just more fun to be at or more welcoming?
Absolutely. My first and foremost, Nine at the Palms. I think it just, it really covers that ambiance that Vegas is. And like I, going back to my first comment that, you know, dining in Vegas really is entertainment unto itself. The Palms is ranked the number one hotel in our book because it really encompasses everything, you know, your heart's desire. And regardless of your age or your, you know, what you're trying to get out of your trip, whether it's pampering or networking, the Palms has it. And Nine over at the Palms is kind of the new steak and seafood restaurant. It's not your typical surf and turf that you might think of from back in the day. They have a world-renowned caviar and champagne bar. There, if you order caviar to the Nines, it's a sample of three caviars with potato cakes. It's to die for. You know, and the cool thing about great steakhouses in Vegas is they also have great bars attached, which kind of gives you more options. Say you want to have a cocktail after your dinner, but you don't want to be stuck to the confines of your table. I think Nine at the Palms definitely has it all for groups of women.
What about the buffets?
Well, you know, Lynn, when you think of buffets, you think about the carving station, the red jello, you know, just a glorified cafeteria,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's so wrong. A few joints here will shatter every negative concept you have of the all-you-can-eat. You know, there's something for everyone at Vegas buffets, and it's really dining room quality. My favorite is the buffet at Wynn Las Vegas. You know, Steve Wynn really got it right this time around. He's dabbled in with the Mirage, the carvings at the Mirage buffet, and mm-hmm. over at the Bellagio. But the buffet at Wynn Las Vegas has these red candy apples that just kind of transport you back in time. And he really does a good job of capitalizing on the women's, you know, we just have that imagination, you know, concept with us. And when we dine, we want to have that atmosphere. And he really gives it all over at Wynn Las Vegas. And it's, you know, you can pay your lunch price at $3.45 and still get your dinner menu that comes on board at 4 p.m. That's a nice little trick, too. So, you know, buffets are fun. And it's Vegas. Why not?
Yeah, and it's, you know, obviously they've had to keep up with the great restaurants that have moved there. Hey,
yes.
Molly, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Molly Sullivan is co-author of Las Vegas Little Red Book, A Girl's Guide to the Perfect Vegas Getaway. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, the answering machine gets lonely. Call it 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this definition of mayonnaise from Ambrose Bierce. He said, and I quote, "One of the sauces which serve the French in place of a state religion." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get yourself registered for our new seasonal e-newsletter, The Griller's Chronicle. Now, it's going to run through the summer grill season, June to September. And just in case you need even more of us, you can also download our weekly podcast. And most remarkable of all, they're all free. So sign up for everything online, splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.